Welcome to Pop Culture Retro, which was recently voted the 15th best podcast by the residents of the Golden Years Retirement Community in Boca Raton, Florida. Each show, we'll revisit some of your favorite pop culture memories with insider and outsider perspectives. Now, please help me welcome your hosts, Ike Eisenman and Jonathan Rosen.
Hello, and welcome to another edition of Pop Culture Retro. If you are a Disney fan, today you will be in heaven. Besides our own regular Disney-certified co-host, Ike Eisenman, we are thrilled to welcome another legend, the producer of some of the most beloved Disney classics of all time, such as Beauty and the Beast, The Lion King, executive producer of Disney Nature Films, owner of the production company Stone Circle Pictures, and author of many Disney books, such as Dancing Corn Dogs in the Night and The Alchemy of Animation. We're thrilled to have be our guest, Don Hahn. Don, thanks so much for joining us today.
It is my pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, to start with, looking at your resume, it's tough to know where to even begin. So many Disney classics and iconic films that have become family favorites. So let's start by asking, what were some of your favorite movies when you were a kid?
Oh, when I was a kid, you know, I kind of grew up on 101 Dalmatians and Jungle Book and those films. I didn't actually go to the movies all that much. We had a drive-in near us, and that was our big treat, because my dad could fit everybody in the back of the station wagon, and you know, we would go to the drive-in and kind of back into a parking space, put the little speaker in the window, and you know, with our pajamas on, open the tailgate of the station wagon, and sit there and watch Jungle Book. You know, it was a really memorable time.
I love drive-in stuff. I always loved that. I never got to go too much as a kid, though. So.
Yeah, talk about retro. It is a vanishing species, but it was, it was really fun, really good times.
When did you first start thinking that you might want to pursue animation and things as a career?
Well, I never really thought that much about animation in particular. I just loved Disney. I never necessarily wanted to work even in Hollywood or film or anything. I just wanted to work at Disney, which is a very different kind of thing. You know, I a lot of friends and colleagues work or wanted to work in animation specifically. And I was a music major in college. I was a drummer and a percussionist, and I played the cello and different things. And so I was really into music as much as anything. And I really loved everything about Disney. That I grew up in the San Gabriel Valley, a town called Bellflower, and I was close to Disneyland. So we would go down there and pay the ridiculously expensive fee of $6.50 to go inside the park, plus 50 cents to park, go have a great day at Disneyland. And, you know, so I really enjoyed that. I enjoyed the Imagineering, you know, specials on the Disney Sunday show. And so, you know, it was just by chance I got a job when I was 20 years old at Disney, and never looked back.
Why? How did that happen? I mean, yeah, you're that involved.
We had a friend at church, actually, who worked in the morgue, which was the place they stored the old animation at Disney. And they needed summer help. And so I left school, left college, and went there to work that summer. But I never really went back to college. And I don't regret it, because it was, you know, it became my university. Disney Studios became my university, because I could study and learn from these artists that were there, and they were great. You know, I was just delivering things. So I would deliver some animation or some drawings or a coffee or something, but I would deliver it to Ken Anderson or to Frank Thomas or Ollie Johnston or Willie Reitherman. And all those guys were still at the studio. And so there was a culture of learning and passing on the animation knowledge that I really got seduced into and thought it was great.
Just curious, what were some of the films that Disney was putting out when you started?
They were just finishing Rescuers, the first Rescuers, and then Pete's Dragon, which I worked on with. I went to Don Bluth needed an assistant, so I went up and worked with Don Bluth for a while, who was the animation director on Pete's Dragon, and that was one of the first movies I worked on. And you know, then from there, Fox and the Hound and Great Mouse Detective and some of those shows. But I think Rescuers and Pete's Dragon were kind of the era I started back in 76.
Well, and so your first responsibilities were like just, you know, taking things around? I'm just curious.
Yeah, they really were, you know. And I, Don Bluth had a movie going in his garage. You know, he was always interested in learning more about the animation process. And there was a general feeling from Don that the studio wasn't necessarily going aggressively into animation. So on the weekends, he would have people over, and they were making a kind of a garage movie called Banjo the Woodpile Cat. And you can probably see that out there in the world somewhere. But it was a place where I could go and learn how to in between. And I was always an artist. I was a painter and an art minor in school. And I learned how to shoot camera and learned how to do a lot of things just on that weekend movie. And then eventually the same thing happened at Disney. I was lucky enough to work there mainly in production. You know, I wasn't so much an artist. I saw early on that I wasn't going to be Glenn Keane or Milt Call or somebody like that. There were a lot of people who, you know, I just didn't have the patience really to sit at a drawing board all day long. And so producing and be working in production was a better fit for me. And so that's kind of the direction I went and worked on, you know, Mickey's Christmas Carol and all those movies. Wow. Just as a production person.
Gosh. I mean, and so you come to Disney, you've already mentioned Don Bluth, and you're immediately working with these legends like Wolfgang Reitherman. Can you tell us a little bit more about working with them and what that was like for you at the time?
Yeah, well, Wooly was interesting because he was the one that Walt Disney gave the responsibility of running animation. You know, Walt was so busy and bogged down with everything else he was doing, which is mainly Disneyland and television, that he had very little time for animation. And so Wooly, he saw as a leader. Wooly was a great animator. He animated a lot of wonderful scenes of Goofy and Monstro and, you know, just amazing stuff going back to the earliest days of Disney features. Great artist and kind of a great leader. Wooly came from the military. He was a fighter pilot in World War II, in the Pacific, and was a pilot all his life. And a real leader and kind of a John Wayne guy, you know, wore Hawaiian shirts and smoked cigars and, you know, real kind of big hearted, but a good leader and a good consensus builder, because the talent at that time were, you know, kind of, I'll say the nine old men, but it was nine old men plus, you know, there was a lot of women, a lot of people like Ken Anderson and other talents at the studio that were beyond that nine, who were big egos and big talents, and somebody had to wrangle all that. And Walt was the ultimate wrangler back in the 30s and 40s. But in this era, it was really Wooly, and he was able to do that. And I was lucky enough to sit in the room. You know, we would record something on Fox and the Hound with Mickey Rooney or whatever, and then go back up to Wooly's office, and I could sit there and play the, you know, my responsibility was to play the takes back, and we would all listen to the takes, and it would be, you know, Frank Thomas and Ollie Johnston and Don Griffith, one of the layout guys, and Wooly, and I was just the gopher. You know, I was just the PA that would sit there and play the tapes. And this was, we didn't have cassette tapes. We had a record album, because when you recorded on the soundstage, the recording stage made a live vinyl record album for you. And we would take that record album up to Wooly's office then, and you could drop the needle anywhere you wanted to and listen to whatever track you wanted to listen to. And those albums still exist. They're in the archives, and they're really interesting because it's the raw, you know, it's everything on this vinyl album. And that's just a technology that was probably there on the soundstage since the 40s and never went away. So a little bit of it was time travel. It was going back into a studio that hadn't really changed that much. I mean, I started 10 years after Walt had died. And there was a sense that he had just passed. You know, people talked about him fondly, and for the most part, you know, he was a taskmaster and you know, someone who demanded excellence from his people. But they loved him in general, you know. And I've worked with a lot of people, the Shermans and Joe Grant, and a lot of people that worked directly with Walt Disney. And I knew Diane, his daughter, and I always tried to get some sense of, well, was this guy just a rotten, terrible, you know, guy? And he wasn't. He was certainly demanding. He certainly had his bad days. and was grouchy, but overall it was all about the work. And he came in the morning, and it was completely about getting the best quality he could. And he was a brilliant person in terms of casting his people. He would hire these really interesting people and then cast them in different ways that were maybe unconventional. And he would come in one morning and say, okay, we're doing an attraction for the World's Fair that has thousands of dolls singing a song about UNICEF. And so Sherman Brothers, we need a song by next week. And if you guys can design some dolls and stuff, that'd be great. And so, and everybody was fearless. It was a very fearless culture when it came to doing whatever needed to be done to entertain the planet. And that was a spirit that I really, to this day, love.
I'm just still a child. You're coming into Disney. You're talking about the Sherman Brothers, the Nine Old Men. I mean, what a start to a career to come on in with those people.
I was lucky. I was really lucky.
I'm jumping around a bit. I mean, your career is just like, you know, so many classics. I want to try to get in when I can. One of your first credits in the production side is one of my favorite films, Who Framed Roger Rabbit. Can you tell us a little bit about that film and working with Zemeckis? And while filming it, did you think that it was going to be this iconic classic that it became?
Well, I had just finished, I guess Great Mouse Detective. And there was an opportunity to start working on Roger Rabbit. Roger Rabbit had been around the studio for a while. And Zemeckis wanted it, but until the management changed over and Eisner and Frank Wells and Katzenberg came into the studio, there wasn't a real opportunity to outreach to the outside industry. So the minute that happened in 1984, then people got a chance to approach Disney and say, hey, there's a property that you have called Roger Rabbit that I really want to work on. And Spielberg and Zemeckis did that. They came in and approached Disney and immediately got that property. I had just worked on Pete's Dragon, as we said before, and mm-hmm. So I knew a little bit about live action and animation combination. And so I was a candidate to go over and start working with them. And that was amazing. You know, I was then working over on the Universal lot in Amblin, which is Steven Spielberg's compound, which is this delightful kind of southwestern it feels like you're in Taos, New Mexico, except you're in Burbank. And being there to work with those guys was another cultural education because, again, they were all about the movie, but in a very relaxed, very collegial way. And Zemeckis was a great writer, obviously, with Back to the Future and a lot of his films. And so being able to be in the room, and I was producing the animation on that movie, and so he wanted to bring in Richard Williams, who was a brilliant animator, Canadian-British animator. And we also hired Chuck Jones at the time, and Chuck came in and helped with some character designs. So to sit there at a table with Chuck and Richard and, you know, storyboard or watch them storyboard was, again, I feel like I was just a Forrest Gump kind of character to be able to see all these things. But I worked my butt off and, tried to show up early and leave late and do everything that had to be done to earn the right to be in those rooms. And somehow that worked out. So that was a great opportunity. And I ended up not necessarily knowing I would work on it, but they liked me and I liked them. And so everybody agreed that I would just go work on the movie when the movie was being made in London. And so I'm this 30-year-old guy who'd been at Disney for a while, but it was a great opportunity to have a breath of fresh air, work in London. And we started from scratch. We got a building up in Camden Town, up in the north of London, an old factory building, and hired people out of off the streets to come and animate. And some of the great, great animators of our generation now, like James Baxter and Nick Ranieri and Tom Cito, Andreas Deja, they all came from that movie. So it was a really good time. Did I know it was going to be a classic? No. We had times when we looked at it and did like screenings of it and thought, oh man, this is this is a stretch. And we actually had one preview screening in Los Angeles, when it was unfinished, it was just pencil tests and a lot of unfinished material where there was a lot of walkouts from the preview audience, which is kind of a disaster. But afterwards, everybody stood around and said, you know, we're not going to tell anybody this happened. We're going to finish the movie and we're going to make whatever changes and edits we need to make. And a lot of it was the audience wasn't used to looking at unfinished animation. Okay. That was a process that had to happen over the next 10 years or so, and happened mostly with Beauty and the Beast and Aladdin, Mermaid. So a lot of it was just people were saying, this is weird. This is like some weird Invisible Man movie with Bob Hoskins talking to nobody in a chair and like, what's going on? So a lot of it was just that misunderstanding on the audience's part. And we just, you know, we just said, okay, well, let's put our heads down and finish the movie. And it was a phenomenon. It was really amazing the way that people reacted to that movie.
Well, I'm one of them. It's a huge favorite of mine as well. And I remember watching in the big climactic scene with all of those animated characters in the same scene, in the same frame at the same time, was just like blew my mind. I mean, you already had Disney support, but what was the kind of agreement you, was it difficult to get the agreement from Warner's and Fleischer Studios to use the characters, and were there any restrictions or promises that needed to be made over their usage?
I think that because Steven Spielberg was involved, that opened a lot of doors because he had good relationships with all the studios. And so we were able to use, you know, Warner Brothers characters freely. There were a few restrictions, particularly with star characters like Bugs Bunny or Mickey Mouse. We had to agree that Mickey and Bugs would be on the screen for the same amount of time, that one wouldn't be favored over another. But some of the secondary characters like Foghorn Leghorn and Yosemite Sam and that we could use pretty freely. And you have to remember, animation wasn't a big deal back then. They hadn't been using these characters in a long time. So it was like, it's like saying, you want Betty Boop? Fine. You know, like she's somewhere, she's in the closet back here somewhere. I don't know. And, but it was delightful because it turns out Betty Boop and Coco the Clown and some of those characters were owned by the Fleshers, and Richard Fleischer was still around, and he was a director that directed 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. And he was, you know, the son of the original like Max Fleischer era guys. And he would come by the studio and talk. So they'd have to do approvals. They'd have to see the work we were doing, but they were so happy to see their characters being used.
Now I was reading up on the Roger Rabbit as well. Now, is it true that all these famous celebrities turned down the role of Eddie Valiant?
Well, I don't know how many did. And that always happens on films, that people either aren't able to do it or don't want to do it for whatever reason. And I think Bob Hoskins was an unconventional choice, but he was so good and he was so physical. You know, his physicality and ability to look at Roger, who was a character that just wasn't there on the screen, he was just an imaginary character, was really extraordinary. So in the end, I think the cast was really amazing. But yeah, there's always people that turn down films and don't sign on. And that's pretty normal, I think.
Now, you had mentioned Pete's Dragon. So it's roughly like 10 years between Pete's Dragon and Roger Rabbit. Do you think Roger Rabbit could have been done 10 years earlier? Or just the technology wasn't...
Well, the technology was still slightly crude. It was still pencil-drawn animation. Without computers or anything else, but I think the biggest thing was the filmmakers, that Zemeckis and the artistic crew were a little more fearless when it came to moving the characters around and moving the camera around. So in older live action animation combination movies, the camera would be locked off with sandbags and you would never want to move it. The dogs are barking.
That's okay. You can't hear mine because she's barking too.
Locked in the next room. So a lot of it was just the freedom of expression that the Zemeckis brought to the show of being able to move the camera, and then we would have to move the animation and draw it along with the camera movement. So there was a lot of that kind of creativity that went into it to discard some of the older rules that applied to live action filmmaking and animation and start to approach it in a new way.
Well, from that, you get your first producing credit, which is Tummy Trouble, Roger Rabbit short, which involved also, like you said, Spielberg and Kathleen Kennedy. Now, what sort of pressure comes with, you know, your first producing credit has Spielberg involved?
Well, they're surprisingly easy to work with as long as you're delivering the goods. They're very supportive. Their notes are good. And they're a very supportive community of people. So it's not, you know, some groups of, especially in Hollywood, can be, bitter screamers, cell phone throwing kind of executives and that kind of thing. And you don't get any of that with most of the people I work with, either at Amblin or at Disney or whatever. There tend to be professionals that are there because they love making movies. So I was lucky that way. Hmm.
Well, moving on to Beauty and the Beast, how did that movie come about for you?
Well, we were finishing Roger Rabbit in London, and Jeffrey Katzenberg called and said he wanted to try doing Beauty and the Beast. It was around the studio for a long time. I think Walt tried, or at least it was on one of his lists of stories to develop for the future. It was always problematic because the main characters really didn't do anything in the course of the movie. They would meet, so there's a beautiful bride and a ugly monster. And he would come down and say, "Will you marry me?" And she would say no, and that was pretty much the movie. So I think the breakthrough with that was to, thanks to a variety of people, have a story that was much more about the growth of the beast and about this character who would redeem himself and slowly become more and more human through the second act, and the introduction of things like the objects, the enchanted objects like clocks and teapots and candelabras. All of that was invented for our version of the movie and just made it more whimsical. It gave it more of a chance to be a musical. Working with Howard and Allen was a great opportunity because Mermaid had just finished up and Aladdin had gone into some story problems. So all of a sudden, Howard and Allen were available, and we were able to talk them into grabbing Beauty and the Beast and writing the song score for that. And of course, that was a huge leg up for us because they brought so much entertainment and joy and drama to the movie with their songs. And Howard really believed in the storytelling through songs and letting the songs tell the plot. So all those things kind of added up to be Beauty and the Beast.
Well, the music is just fantastic. And, you know, I was going to ask you about Ashman and Menken, and you wrote and directed also the documentary Howard about Howard Ashman. Can you talk a little bit about your relationship with him and, you know, just his music in general?
Well, Howard was, pretty much one-stop shopping when it came to storytelling. He wasn't necessarily a musician. He was a great singer. Understood musicals and understood musical theater better than anyone I've ever known, meaning he understood the genre of musical theater, but also where to place songs and how to musicalize parts of the plot to turn it into a musical, which is no small thing. I mean, a lot of people misunderstand musicals and they'll paste songs on a story and think it's a musical, but it's really not. I think Howard really focused us all on the true American Broadway musical, which was taking the key points of the plot where the characters are most in trouble or most in love and musicalizing those moments. And that's something Howard and Allen did beautifully in all of their work. And so it was good. I mean, working with them was, Howard was living in New York at the time and spending a few weeks every month in Los Angeles. So it was very demanding on all of us to really have that be important time where we could all work on the movie together. Sure. And then eventually as he became sick and wasn't able to come to Los Angeles that much. And so we went to him and then sadly he passed away before the movie was done, before he even saw it. But we got enough of an influx of his work along with some great, great people, Kirk Wise, Gary Trousdale, our directors and our writers and amazing story people that all added up to making Beauty and the Beast what it is.
And you just mentioned adding adding, you know, the characters like the enchanted objects. And is that how also how Gaston came in? Because Gaston to me is like one of the great villains in all of Disney Disney films. So how did that come about? How did he come about, that character?
Well, he was not necessarily in the original fairy tale, but we knew we wanted someone who was the opposite of the Beast. So if the Beast was a ugly guy with the heart of gold, then Gaston had to be an incredibly handsome guy with a messed up heart. And at first Gaston was drawn as kind of a fop, as kind of a, you know, a fancy dandy from the 17th century. And that became a little, I don't know, there just wasn't much entertainment in it. And then slowly some of the drawings started to suggest more of a mountain man, a hunter, because the Beast was a beast, and to have a threat to him would be, well, a hunter, obviously. And in no small part, he's based on a character named Milus Gloriosus. And that will send your audience to Wikipedia.
Good.
Milus Gloriosus is a character in Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, and also a character in I think in mythology. And he is a soldier and a brutish hunter with massive biceps who comes marching into town and is incredibly impressed with himself. So that's Gaston, and that's Milus Gloriosus. So, you know, I think that's, there's a great song and Funny Thing Happened to the Forum,
it's a great musical.
On the Way to the Forum, that's all about Milus Gloriosus and how he's conquered the millions and brought peace to his people, and thank God you have me. And you know, he's reminiscent actually of some modern politicians that we've seen recently, not to mention any names, but very kind of narcissistic and all about himself. And that was perfect for Gaston. And then the fact that he was a hunter and had antlers everywhere was, you know, another great visual thing. So that's where Gaston comes from.
Oh, yeah. So I can blame you guys, because I still have antlers and all of my decorating is an earworm in my head constantly from that song. It just cracks me up endlessly. But you know, speaking of that, what goes into deciding to stick to the source material, or you know, changing it to fit a Disney movie? Because it always seems to me, historically, at least from certainly my experience, every time I see a Disney movie, it feels like a Disney movie, and it becomes that through this process. So where does that line come for you guys?
Well, it's interesting. It kind of is a grassroots approach. In the last 50 years, there's no Walt Disney to kind of guide that along, although there's a small group of people that created that Disney house style, not the least of which is Walt, but still very important players were people like Joe Grant, who was head of the character department at Disney, or Bill Peet, who was one of the really crucial story people at Disney. Certainly the animators like Milt Kahl. So there's a lot of names that your audience may not have heard. Ken Anderson, who worked on those movies, Mark Davis, who designed and worked on all the women like Tinkerbell and Maleficent and Cruella. And then Walt said, well, Mark, go over and work on Disneyland. And Mark was like, okay, I've never done that, but I'll do that. And so he designs the Pirates of the Caribbean ride and designs a bunch of stuff for the Haunted Mansion and the Jungle Cruise. And so again, you have these unique artists who were jacks of all trade, who were willing to do anything, and did for Walt. And Walt challenged them and believed in them. And I think that was what was so unique. So these guys invented kind of that process and the look of a Disney film. Freddie Moore was another one who designed the look and the characters and the movement of animation in Snow White of the Dwarves, and really looked like what we would consider Disney animation. So, and then you have my generation, which is kind of the students of all those men and women who invented the animation process back in the 20s and 30s. And we are the next generation. And so we were just fans and grew up on that stuff and had our own version of it. I mean, I think Little Mermaid and Beauty and Aladdin and Lion King are not completely like Pinocchio and you know, Snow White and some of those films. I honestly don't think we reached the level of artistry they reached in films like Pinocchio. Pinocchio was pretty much an artistic miracle. Mm-hmm. I don't think we ever got to that point. But we got great stories, and I think we did excel and maybe did even better than the original Disney movies in terms of our storytelling. And that was our strong suit. And part of that was the musicals and the songs we had. And part of that is we had just great men and women in the story department writing and creating these things. And so when you're sitting in those rooms coming up with ideas for movies, you have a group instinct about what is entertaining, and you're making the movies for yourself and your family and for the kids on the block that live around you. You know, there's no executives that come in the room that tell you it has to be a certain way. There's no consumer products people that come in and say, we need a princess doll. I mean, you might think that was the case, but it wasn't ever the case. Mm. You really are there making something for the audience, and the audience is your boss.
I was about to ask you. I mean, how much autonomy do you have when you're working for Disney? I mean, do they oversee every little thing, or no, you can just go ahead and do what you would like on a lot of the work?
In general, the group, meaning the myself and the directors and the story team, had a lot of autonomy, and we would always have to present to executives, but they were busy with other things, and they wanted us to keep going and making these movies. And so you had tremendous autonomy to make it interesting. And the only time we were ever stopped is if we weren't sure if something crossed a line. Was it too intense? Mm-hmm. We never really put sexuality into the movies. We would put something perhaps once in a while that was too violent. Scar's death comes to mind. And he falls off a cliff. And in the end, we illustrated it with a shadow on a wall. And that's, something they did in Pinocchio and many other films. So you're not seeing him get ripped apart by hyenas. Not that that wouldn't be cool, but you're seeing it as a shadow on the wall and something that is not going to be, it's more of a poetic filmic license than something that's too intense for small children. Mm-hmm. And yet, having said that, the films of Walt Disney are at times very intense. If you look at Pinocchio and
sure.
Pleasure Island and Stromboli and intensity of little boys being turned into donkeys and all that, Bambi's mother getting shot. We often cited those in terms of trying to be brave with Mufasa being killed, or with Belle and the Beast fighting back wolves out in the wilderness, or whatever. The intensity is not bad, and you need that. You need the drama. So really you have to be kind of self-policing and really aware and an advocate for your audience. You don't want to betray your audience. You want to be loyal to the audience when they buy their ticket and go see your movie, to be able to have an expectation that it's going to be dramatic and funny as can be, and within the bounds of a family movie.
Eventually, Beauty and the Beast, gets nominated for Best Picture. How validating, how excited was everyone when that happens?
Yeah, well, that goes back to something we were talking about a while ago, where we were really trying to educate the audience to look at animation and understand that it was an art form. It's a great American art form. Certainly there are international animators that are brilliant. But feature animation, character animation in the Disney style is obviously very American. And so for Beauty and the Beast in particular, we had a screening at the New York Film Festival, which New York would never dream in a million years of accepting any Disney film. here's a town full of incredibly erudite critics, and the idea of having a Disney animated film in the festival was really unique. But to their credit, they saw that it was something new, that Disney was bringing back a part of their legacy and bringing it back in a fresh way. And so we showed an unfinished version at the New York Film Festival. And that was really a turning point where people understood that these were drawn by hand by people. They were painted with paint. We did museum shows at the time. Wow. And many things that actually Walt did in his era. He did museum shows with Sleeping Beauty and other movies. But it was really an education process. And I think that led to the Academy understanding that it was an art form that could be acknowledged. And so back in the day when there were only five Best Picture nominations, to get a Best Picture nomination was extraordinary. And you know, and it was very deliberate. It was courted. You know, we definitely went after the Golden Globe Award to try to set up the opportunity to get an Oscar nomination. In fact, I think I have it here somewhere. Hold on.
Oh, wow.
Here it is.
Lovely. So, lovely.
Awesome.
What else do you need? So, you know, we would try to hit some of these milestones of awards and things, which is very common. You know, anybody who wins a Best Picture or Best Actor campaigns, it's like a political campaign. You really campaign amongst the Oscar voters. So it was a real honor. It was a real honor to be acknowledged, because Walt Disney never really got that acknowledgement. Sure. And even, I mean, even to this day, you know, 30 years later, people talk about that. And so it was a real honor, I think, and not just for me, but totally for the artists and for the studio to have that kind of acknowledgement from the industry.
Mm-hmm. I was absolutely blown away when the nomination came out, and I was so excited to, and of course, I always watched the Academy Awards, but in my humble opinion, it should have won that year. But Silence of the Lambs took the honor, which is a great movie, but of course, completely different. And it's so hard to put these two films up against each other. And I know it didn't happen until a lot of years later. But do you think Beauty and the Beast influenced the Academy to create the Best Animated Feature Award?
I think it did, because the quality of animation stayed high. And through some really great movies at Disney Animation, at Pixar, whatever. And I think that, you know, you could look at it in a jaded way and say, well, the Academy didn't want animation to take any of its Best Picture nominations. So they created this kind of side category over here that would marginalize animation. Mm-hmm. I don't look at it that way at all. I feel like it's a great tribute to be able to put animation on a pedestal and say it's an important art form. It's a very lucrative art form. It makes money for the industry. And these days there's probably 15 or 20 animated features every year, which is so different than when Beauty came out. So there's enough candidates where you can look at the nominees this year, where there was a movie called Flea about immigrants. There's, you know, main studio movies. There's, just a variety of products coming out, and they're all good. I mean, my God, there's so much animation going on right now. And in live action movies, like a lot of the Marvel movies are becoming more animated. So the idea of, it used to be long ago where you say, well, what's animated? Well, it has to be like a flying elephant or something like that. Not anymore. I mean, anything can be animated. Anything can be turned into an animated movie, and that's great. It's the way it should be. The art form has moved ahead a tremendous amount.
Well, you also produced Lion King, another great movie, still the highest grossing traditionally animated film of all time. Can you tell us how that film came about for you?
Jeffrey Katzenberg, Peter Schneider, Roy Disney, we're on a plane in Europe selling Oliver and Company with press junkets. And Jeffrey said, you know, someday we should do a coming of age story. And Roy said, yeah, like Bambi in Africa. And so that was the beginning of it. We called it Bambi in Africa for a long time.
Oh my.
And then early drafts of the movie were called King of the Jungle. And it really was an exploration into, can we do something set in nature that's very much like Bambi, that's about growing up and about that day in your life when you have to grow up and accept responsibility for being an adult. And sometimes that comes with the birth of a child. Sometimes it comes with the death of a parent, or, you know, whatever. So it's dealing with some pretty deep issues, our relationships with our fathers. And Rob Minkoff and Roger Allers directed that movie, and the three of us had really good relationships with our dads. That's really a movie about that. In fact, we were going to dedicate it to our fathers. And then it, sadly, at the last minute, Frank Wells passed away in a helicopter crash, and we ended up dedicating it to him. But it's a movie about our relationships with our fathers and our ancestors, and that we're walking around with all this genetic and philosophical information from our generations past, and that we have a certain obligation to move that forward and to be the best we can be. And so those are really kind of fun, deep issues to deal with. And at the same time, we had a farting warthog and funny stuff in the movie as well. So it really came out of that Bambi in Africa growing up kind of idea.
Now, was it true that ABBA was approached to do the music for that?
Yeah, one of the first people on was Tim Rice, because Tim had come in to fill in for Howard Ashman when Howard passed away. And he finished some of the songs on Aladdin, A Whole New World was Tim Rice's lyrics. And he would work with Benny and with the people from ABBA on Chess, which was a right. West End Broadway musical that was really successful. And so they were one of the first people he approached and thought they would be fantastic for this. And, you know, they would have been. I think we think of them in a very narrow box. But talk about narrow box. Elton John came up. Tim had never worked with Elton John. Elton John had never written a musical or a Broadway show. And when we heard Elton John, we thought, Elton John? Because we were honestly thinking, Ladysmith, Black Mambazo, Paul Simon, Graceland, all those kinds of things, which were very of the moment and terrific. Like the Graceland album was a huge hit. Mm-hmm. And we thought, wow, that would be the kind of music. Well, in the end, we got that kind of music and more. Elton turned out to be a great collaborator. I can't say he had no ego about the process, but he's remarkably collaborative and remarkably would hit our requests for songs and things right on the money. And if he didn't, he would be happy to go back and rewrite something. Like he wrote Circle of Life a couple of times. Mm. He wrote, Tim wrote the lyrics to Can You Feel the Love Tonight about 20 times. So they were very willing to move things around and collaborate and change things in a way that really benefited the movie. And then Hans Zimmer coming in and writing the score in a way that really borrowed heavily from African music and indigenous music, and bringing in somebody like Lebo M, the singer who sings that opening cry in the wilderness. That kind of thing was really fresh, new, risky, scary, but all worked out in the end.
Mm. You had such a great cast in Lion King as well. We had interviewed Tommy Chong, who said that he had been approached too, but you had still had some great cast members there. Can you tell us any anecdotes about making that movie with all that great cast?
Well, I think our approach to it was to do a colorblind cast, which, I mean, later when the kind of live action version of Lion King was done just a couple of years ago, mm-hmm. it was very much an African or African-American cast, which was, and rightly so. I think back then, I don't think we felt that kind of particular pressure, although we knew we wanted a colorblind cast of a variety of voices. So it was okay for James Earl Jones's son to be Matthew Broderick. It was okay to have, just a variety of people regardless of their skin color, because you weren't seeing that on the screen. So James Earl Jones was great to work with, really a pro, really, really an amazing guy to work with. And we were able to try some things with him. Like when he's a ghost, we put 5 microphones around his head. So you have a left, center, right, and rear microphones. The audience is almost in his head when he's speaking. And his voice obviously is fantastic. Whoopi Goldberg, Cheech Marin, amazing people. And then Nathan Lane and Ernie Sabella were Broadway talent that not a lot of people had heard of. They were in Guys and Dolls on Broadway, and they came in and auditioned for The Hyenas, and they were fine. They were fine. But then Roger Allers, who was one of the directors, said, "Would you guys stick around and just read these new pages on Pumbaa Timon?" Because we were thinking about Eddie Murphy or different people for Timon, And so they said, sure. And they stayed around. And since they had worked together in Guys and Dolls, they had this chemistry between the two of them. Mm. And they came back and just knocked everybody on the floor with how funny they were. And so they were great. And we recorded them as much together as we could because they had such a strong relationship. And a lot of their material is ad-libbed. You know, we would write things, but a lot of the, you know, what do you want me to do? Dress and drag and do the hula? Just was making stuff up on the fly. And you want that. You want that energy from the voice talents, sure. Because that is gold mm-hmm. to the animators who have to make those characters perform. So great cast all around, you know, to be able to deal with those people and the singing demands that they had. And it was never about star power because, you know, the Circle of Life song, we always thought, well, we'll get Harry Belafonte or we'll get Seal or someone to sing that song, a star. And in the end, Carmen Twilley sings it. Well, nobody knew who Carmen Twilley was. She was actually a singer from the chorus. It was a background singer, basically, in recording sessions. And she came in and sang the demo of it just so that we'd have something to listen to. And we fell in love with it. And we kept looking for somebody else to sing that opening song, and we could never beat it. So mm-hmm. Carmen, who is, you know, was at the time a relative unknown, is the person who sings that song. Or Lebo, that African voice you hear throughout the whole movie, was parking cars for a valet parking service in Los Angeles. And he was a refugee from South Africa because apartheid was just breaking loose and dissolving in South Africa. In fact, he voted for the first time in 1994. So Africa was kind of in the air when Lion King came out. Mm. And Hans Zimmer was looking for him. And literally a few hours before we showed up at Hans's studio, he found Lebo. And Lebo came by. And we said, Lebo, we need this kind of cry in the wilderness at the beginning of the movie. It's kind of a John the Baptist thing, you know, where you're saying, you know, make way for the new king. And so he said, okay. And there, it wasn't in a recording studio. It was in a room with a microphone. And he tried a couple things and then came out with that thing that we're all used to as kind of an improv on what he thought might work. So he, along with the planning and the writing and the serious nature of telling a story, you also have to be open to improvisation and chance and take those opportunities when they come along.
Oh my gosh, that's I love this stuff to death. So now you go on to Hunchback, which is another really beautiful movie with a great soundtrack. And these are kind of, again, more of the behind the scenes stories I love hearing about. I read that Meat Loaf and Mandy Patinkin were considered for Quasimodo.
Yeah, I mean, we would do a lot of reading and casting for all these parts. Yeah. And that's true. Yeah, Meatloaf and Mandy both came in. You know, you can never say that they don't work because they're amazing. And Mandy Patinkin is a genius, you know, so mm-hmm. It's not that they don't work. It's just they might not have the right tone for what you're looking for. And, you know, it just still wasn't quite a fit for what we had. So, you know, in the same as the case with like Demi Moore, as she was a great, strong character to play a Roma gypsy character, because a lot of the movie is about the oppression of, you know, of people. And it's a very timely movie still, whether it be a person that's physically disabled or a person who's part of a race like the Roma. In Europe during the time, and she was able to play that strength. And or Tony Jay, who played Frollo, the bad guy from the church. Those were tough characters to cast because you want them to be strong and yet have the ability to play the musical parts you know, all the demands that you have in these movies. And so in the end, you would cast and try several people. And then you get lucky with somebody who just was a fit, like Demi, or like Kevin Kline, who played Phoebus, or even like Robbie Benson, who was the Beast. You know, he's probably the last person you thought of to cast as the Beast, but he was just a perfect fit in the end.
Mm-hmm. Now you went back. You did Beauty and the Beast, and you're making a live action version of Hunchback. I read. So, how difficult is it to go back and revisit something that, you know, was so great the first time, and now you know, decide to change it up a little bit?
Well, luckily there's fresh faces and new writers and directors that come along to reinterpret things. And I always believe stories are meant to be told, and they're not meant to sit on the shelf for too long. And it's been over 20 years since mm-hmm. these movies have come out. So it's appropriate to me to tell those stories again, and to be able to bring in new writers and new directors and a new cast to try to retell that story. And of course you get the benefit of new songs like, Alan Menken's working on Little Mermaid right now, a new version of that.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, and so you get some new songs from Alan for that. And Lin-Manuel Miranda is writing the lyrics for that. So you get Lin-Manuel, who was incredibly inspired by Howard Ashman and the films that we made back in the 90s, now is grown up and a brilliant writer, and is collaborating with Alan on the retelling of these stories. And that's a cool thing. That's really great. Right. And so you, the original movies will always be there. They'll never get lost. You can always pop in and look at Lion King or Mermaid, but you can also enjoy, you know, Kenneth Branagh's version of Cinderella, or you know, some of the retellings that have been done lately. And the retelling of those stories is great. There's not that many stories in the universe. And so it makes sense. In fact, if you look at some of the upcoming slates of all the studios, you think like, is there anything fresh out there? But it makes sense sometimes to go back and revisit those great stories of the past, like Maleficent. You know, it was a different spin on the Sleeping Beauty story, with a character invented by Mark Davis. You know, so here you have this animator who's eventually went on to design theme parks, who invented Maleficent, from who's not in the original fairy tale, and that ends up being something Angelina Jolie wants to do and turns into a series of movies that's a huge hit for the studio.
You just mentioned music. I just want to ask, in the 90s you had all those string of great musicals, and then the studio seemed like it shifted away from making the animated musicals. Was that just a conscious decision, or just a shift in audience taste that they decided to stay away from that a little bit?
Well, that's a great question. I'll be as honest as I can with the answer, which is, I think it's like sports. You have winning seasons and you have slumps. And I think a lot of the movies, let's take a look at the last 30 years, maybe, you have a bell curve of movies in terms of box office. Some are very appreciated in their time, but don't age very well. Other movies become huge hits over time, like Nightmare Before Christmas. But when Nightmare came out, nobody went to see it. It was not a hit when it came out. Same with Emperor's New Groove. And now when I go to like Comic-Con or conventions or whatever, and people say, you know, what did you work on, Don? And I'll proudly say, well, Lion King. And then they find out I worked on Emperor's New Groove, and they go, oh my God, I know every line of that movie. And you know, that's their go-to movie, because they were the right age when it came out, and it's their cult movie. And so one never knows. But certainly, like sports, like the arts of any kind, and like business, I suppose, is you have an ebb and flow of success and less than success. And you see that in Walt Disney's life, you see it in Pixar, you see it in Disney, you see it in Warner Brothers. And that's what happens to all of us. So I think, you know, you look at Disney now and they're turning out some really incredible movies like mm-hmm. Moana and, you know, so many great movies from Disney Animation. And there's been years when the movies weren't that great. And it's not that the effort goes into them is any different, or the budget, or the desire to make a great movie. Like we made, I produced Atlantis, and we wanted to do something different. Instead of going down Main Street through the castle to Fantasyland, we deliberately said, we're going to go down to the hub and turn left and go to Adventureland. And Atlantis is an Adventureland movie. And everybody got that and made that movie. And again, now it's a cult movie. Everybody's just Disney Plus is out. Everybody loves that movie. But at the time, it wasn't the massive success that Lion King was. But you know, you put these movies out there, and eventually they find their audience.
Well, you just mentioned Atlantis and Emperor's New Groove. I count me in part. I love Emperor's New Groove, and I always have. I love David Spade. Patrick Warburton kills me in everything that he's in, and I still watch. I laugh every single time that I watch that movie at the same lines. I know what lines are coming. What is it about that? What do you remember about making it? And what do you think that? When did you first start seeing it? I guess that it had become this cult classic that got this second life.
Well, that movie went through the meat grinder when it came to the production of it. It started out as something a little more dramatic. Roger Allers, who directed Lion King, was directing it. And it was about a Incan boy in the Incan civilization who roped the sun. Very mythological and beautiful. It's amazing artwork done on it. It wasn't very funny. And I think about that time, I think we were all kind of feeling like we wanted to try something different. And so through a number of different reasons, Mark Dindal came into the project, and Mark was the director on that movie. And Mark is a ridiculously funny, irreverent person who put together a story team of writers like Dave Reynolds, who was a writer on the Conan O'Brien show, and you know, a variety of people who made it into what it was. And I think it was just, we were all ready for that. I don't think there was any expectation while we were making it that it was going to be a billion-dollar hit. You know, I think it was going to be, if we were lucky, a stand-up single, you know, if we were able to hit the ball. But we knew we had great music with Sting, even though we threw out half the songs he had written for the earlier version. And Sting kept resigning, and we kept the producer, Randy Fulmer, kept calling him up and saying, okay, well, we're going to go on to the next song. And Sting kept saying, I'm leaving the project. No, you're not. You're going to keep showing up. And he did. To his credit, he kept showing up. But the movie's beautiful, irreverent. The cast is probably the best ever. And then the writing is really clever. It's kind of Simpsons levels, silly, stupid writing with, you know, Eartha Kitt in the same movie as David Spade. And it's just one of those things. Happy accident. So I'm really proud of that movie, and yeah, the whole crew did a great job on it. But it was just a different tone. You know, it wasn't the self-serious princess movie. It was just a totally different departure. And boy, did we need it by that time. You know, if you have meat and potatoes every night for 5 years, you're ready for some tacos after a while. You know, you want breakfast. Chimichanga. And so that was our chimichanga.
Well, it might not be tacos, but we want to ask about Haunted Mansion with Eddie Murphy. That and Pirates of the Caribbean came out roughly at the same time. What do you remember about the discussions to turn the rides into movies?
Well, Haunted Mansion was wow, wonderful and terrible. It was the only good thing about Pirates is it really pushed us to be the best movie we possibly could be. We had great art direction. We had great people that loved the attraction. Rob Minkoff, great director. Eddie Murphy, pretty brilliant, but Eddie had been off of some not so great movies like Pluto Nash. And I think his star was fading a little bit at the time. I think the story worked. I think the movie itself works. But it just, the elements of that movie were an experiment. Can you make an attraction into a movie? And then somewhere along that line, then the Pirates of the Caribbean film came out, and it was terrific. And we knew it. Mm-hmm. I mean, we knew when we saw that and saw what, and they went through a lot of conflict too with Johnny Depp's character. And, you know, he shows up with a golden tooth and half drunk on stage. And that's going to be the character, is a challenging character to accept for the studio. But thank God they did, because it was a really fresh take on that story. Mm-hmm. So it goes back to the idea of reinvention, that you have to kind of reinvent these stories. And the basic Haunted Mansion story or the basic pirate story are good, but you have to bring in fresh elements to anything like that to make it spectacular. And, you know, whether it's a casting person or a visual effect idea or whatever, and that's what really makes those movies excel. You're not just repeating the ride. You're not just doing the movie of the Matterhorn. You're turning it into something completely different.
Well, that's an interesting point that you just made. I mean, Haunted Mansion is my favorite ride. So when you're converting it into a movie, how much, you know, talk goes into, like, you know, giving fan service with like a little bit of Easter eggs thrown in from the ride or a fresh new take? I mean, what kind of discussion does that entail?
Well, we were really aware of the backstory of the ride and all the history of it and the work that Yale Gracie and a lot of people did on the ride, even going back to when it was a walk-through wax museum kind of place, the Museum of the Weird. So we were very aware of the history and the mythology that went into it. And so, yes, you want to give Easter eggs, you want to give some satisfaction to the audience that they're going to see Madame Leota. They're going to see some things that they can point to and say, oh, that's, you know, that's what I remember from the attraction. But you have to incorporate those in a way that maybe they aren't in the ride. In the ride, they're kind of vignettes and one-offs. And in a movie, they have to be integrated more in part of the plot and be more more of a narrative element. And and so that's the challenge.
And how was Eddie Murphy like to work with?
He was good. You know, what's funny about, and this happens to a lot of comedians, is they tend to be somewhat quiet and introverted when you first work with them. The same is true of Steve Martin comes to mind. When the camera rolls, then they light up and they turn into Steve Martin or Eddie Murphy. Right. So Eddie's he's an observer, he's a student. He, you know, God, he would go home at nighttime and watch dozens of movies to try to inform his character and his personality and his look and what he would wear and everything else. So he's a real student of acting and what it would take in the part. So a real pro, I have to say, a real pro to work with. And I think you don't do as many movies as he has and have the success he has without having that real pro kind of side to you where you know how to prepare and show up and make the jokes work.
Yeah, I found that to be true of Chris Rock. I had the opportunity to work with him on a project and he was very much the same way. He was like very, very kind of a little bit introverted, but then all of a sudden when he went to work, it was like, wow, that's, you know, there's the Chris Rock we know and love. Now, I know there's another Haunted Mansion movie in the works. Are there any other ride movies being planned? Maybe it's a small world after all.
Probably, but I don't know. I mean, I don't, I'm on to other things. So, you know, I think we've been developing a Hunchback of Notre Dame film for a long time, which is great. But I, you know, if there's a good idea out there for an attraction, absolutely. You know, who knew that Jungle Cruise would make a good attraction, but it's a great movie, you know, and it's a fun Indiana Jones kind of take on that idea. Absolutely. So there's always a way if there's someone inventive enough to look at it, you know, look at a ride, look at a, do the Monsanto movie or whatever, and have a, something that is, fun for the audience to revisit. And it I mean, what's a little bit different now is, the movies are going into the parks. It used to be that the parks were standalone experiences. Mm-hmm. So you would go to Adventureland and the Jungle Cruise wasn't based on any movie. The Haunted Mansion wasn't based on any movie. Those were just in the collective real estate of the audience. Everybody knew what a haunted house was. Everybody knew what a pirate was. So the collective consciousness of the audience said, oh, pirates, well, let's go see what that is. Now the more common approach is to say, let's take Avatar or let's take Star Wars and put those already a developed baked premise as a movie. Let's put those narratives in the parks. And that's exactly backwards of what the original parks did. And I'm not making a value judgment on that. I think those are terrific experiences. It's just a different approach. So it's a little easier because the movies are already made and then you can go visit the land.
I do want to ask you about Disney Nature, your the ones that you produced, and there are such great films on there. You can catch them all on Disney Plus. How did that come about? How did that idea to start doing these type of documentaries come about?
Well, the nature movies were very much a part of Walt Disney's kind of genesis after the war, World War II, and there had been a terrible labor strike at the studio. And he just thought, I'm going to come back with a lot of different approaches and diversify. He didn't want to put all of his eggs in one basket as he had done with animation, because if animation were to go belly up, then they would be screwed, if you'll excuse the language. So he decided to get into eventually the television and theme parks and all these other places. Well, one of those was nature movies. Now we are bombarded with nature movies. You can turn on any channel, any time and see a nature movie. But at the time, it wasn't the case. So to create Seal Island or just one of his early nature movies was really different. And his True Life Adventure series was one of a kind, you know, and he couldn't get any studio to really release that movie. He had worked before with RKO to release his animated films, but he would show them the nature movies and they would say, well, you know, we don't get this, good luck. And that's when he and Roy founded Buena Vista Distribution, because it's like, well, we'll just build our own distribution company to distribute their nature movies. So the core of a lot of the Disney businesses come from those nature movies, and their early ones all won Oscars as the best documentaries. So they were really well received by the audience. They were short, they were like 45 minutes long. So, but brilliantly done by a variety of filmmakers who would go out in the field for years and film, you know, seals or lemmings falling off of cliffs, which is a whole nother story. And those stories became really popular with the audience. But that was really carved out by Walt, and nobody wanted them. And that's kind of a typical story for Walt and Roy Disney, is to take something that they loved and turn it into a project. And then at Disneyland, they had, you know, Adventureland was originally called True Life Adventureland. And it was simplified down to Adventureland, but that was meant to be the place you went to experience these True Life adventures. And that's why the Jungle Cruise is there and that kind of thing. So you can start to see how all these things kind of germinated and turned into what we now know as Disneyland and the Disney nature movies, and now Nat Geo and some of the nature things that are on Disney Plus are just spectacular.
Yeah.
So that was fun. I loved working with those guys. We worked with a lot of people from BBC Nature, people that go out and film chimpanzees for years at a time.
That one's a great one.
Really unique people. But incredibly dedicated, very funny, long-suffering, and their movies were really fun to work on.
Are you a big Disney file in general?
Yeah, I am. I'm not a historian. I'm not a you know, as somebody that knows everything about you know, everything at Disney. But I admire a lot of the people, and I am inspired by a lot of the people. And it's not to say everybody was perfect at Disney or everybody today is perfect at Disney. We're all human beings. But I think the ethics and the aesthetic that has driven Disney for 100 years is pretty fantastic. And I still get inspired by that, inspired by the story of Walt Disney and Roy Disney, and mm-hmm. especially inspired by the artists that kind of invented theme parks and animation, because I got to work with them and see that they, you know, they put their pants on one leg at a time, and they were just dedicated to doing great work. And, you know, they're very normal people driven by a passion to do great entertainment so that you and I go to the theme parks and are blown away. And that's a special kind of person. And those people inspire me still today.
Mm-hmm. Well, I am very proud to say that I have one of my original harmonica props from Witch Mountain. So from all cool. the movies you've made for them. Yeah, I do. It's like, I talk about this constantly. It's right next to my television on a shelf. And so I see it every, all day, all the time. But from all the movies you made for them, were there any props that you kept?
Yeah. I mean, my house isn't terribly decorated with Disney stuff, although I have a shelf of maquettes, which are the sculptures that we made
for
animated movies.
Yeah.
For the animators to study. And you can probably see them behind me. There's
Oh, absolutely.
Everybody's back here, the Beast.
Oh, wow. And, I see the Beast. Right. Yes.
Okay, that's Fox, fantastic.
Foxworth and everyone. So those are my friends. And if I get lonely, I can reach back and grab one of those. And, you know, those are probably the nicest things that I've hung on to. You know, otherwise I would be a hoarder, and I would be impossibly, you know, my garage is already full of too many things. So
I wanted to tell us a little bit about Stone Circle Pictures.
Oh, you know, it's been 10 years ago or more. Well, it's interesting. I got to a point where I had to, decide whether I was going to keep going and make animated films or move on. And it was a really hard decision. I, in the end, decided to move on for some simple reasons. One, I got some validation from the idea that because Walt Disney moved on from animation after a while, it's a very intense activity. But I also had things to say. I wanted to make documentaries about social issues that meant something to me. And I especially wanted to make documentaries about artists and artists that were my heroes, like Tyrus Wong, who art directed Bambi, or Howard Ashman. And so that's what I've done. I've made, in the end, I think I've made more documentaries now than I have animated films. And so this last 10 or 15 years has been all about that. It's a art form that I strongly suggest to all of you out there, because you can go out and buy the equipment and make a really high quality documentary for pennies, depending as opposed to what you could a long time ago. Yeah, I shoot a lot of my, you know, a lot of the Howard Ashman documentary I shot on my iPhone in 4K. You know, it's very approachable. Or I have, you know, I'll get a GoPro 10 now available from and shoot it in a very tiny camera that shoots extremely high quality. And so that kind of thing, it makes it very gratifying as a filmmaker. Doing an animated film with 300 people over 4 years is one experience that I will always treasure. But I was ready for an experience that was a smaller experience. You can make a documentaries with five people and tiny budgets. And I make them for only Disney and only for PBS, because I admire both companies. They both have a lot in common. And I've been on the board of PBS out here in Southern California for a while. And so I'll do documentaries for them because I love the kind of programming they both do. For example, I have a documentary for this Christmas called Christmas with Walt Disney, that I'm working on right now. And it's a movie I made 10 years ago for Diane Disney Miller. And it was literally, I mean, that's what it's about. It's about celebrating Christmas with Walt and his family. And, it showed at the museum for 10 years, just to a few people. And now Disney Plus picked it up and wants to show it to, you know, 100 million people on the cable service. So that'll be out there at the holiday season, which I'm really proud of. Or I did the walkthrough of the Disney archives not too long ago and spent a couple of days shooting, running through the archives, showing everybody the cool collection of stuff they have there. And that's on Disney Plus. So those are the kinds of things I really enjoy doing now. And I've had so many blessings in my career that I feel like I can play with some of those things now. And I've done one of the first documentaries I did for Stone Circle. And that's my production company that is produces these documentaries. And I created it for that reason. The first documentary I did was about a guy named Mike Carroll. Mike Carroll is the photographer for Disney Magazine when that existed. And he also did the Birnbaum travel guides. And back in 1988, he saw that he was a photojournalist for the Boston Globe at the same time. And he saw there was a need in Romania because Ceausescu and the Iron Curtain had fallen, and he raised a bunch of money and went over there and started an organization called Romanian Children's Relief. And he's not Romanian. He has nothing to do with Romania, but he wanted to help. And now 30 years later, this same guy, I talked to him this week, actually, he still has that organization going. He has 60 employees. And he's taking care of 800 refugees from the Ukraine who have flooded into Romania and are in his program now, mothers and children. And he's supplying them not necessarily with food and clothing, because there's plenty of people for that, but he's working with Boston Hospital to supply them with coaching for, you know, just trauma and some of the things they've been through. So here's a guy who's very Disney, who's called to action by something that's happening in the real world. And boy, what an inspiring guy he is. That's why I started Stone Circle, is to tell those stories.
Wow. Wow. Well, you've also authored several books on animation, such as Drawn to Life and the Disney Animation Kit. Have you thought about teaching a master class on it?
It's funny you should say that, because I have, and some people have asked if I would, particularly about storytelling. You know, I think there's better people than I, like people like Eric Goldberg or Andreas Deja or Glenn Keane, that can teach animation beautifully. I'm really interested in storytelling and why we need stories, why stories are kind of the currency of our life and how we communicate. So yeah, I think at some point I need to do that, just to sit down and make a web series or something on YouTube that can kind of communicate what it is that I think is important about storytelling. I love teaching. Although I don't want to go into the, I've taught at Chapman University and USC and some different places, just as a one-off, you know, just a lectures and things. I don't want to be a full-time faculty member. So I still like making movies, but I do like to share what I know. Not that what I know is so precious, but I feel like it's good to at least share that and challenge other people to kind of gather their thoughts about what they think about storytelling or what they think about social issues or whatever.
Well, that would be great. You should do that online. I'll look forward to
absolutely.
That.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, I will. Thank you for encouraging me. I thank you.
Mm-hmm. Well, so on the same subject, you know, my son is like all into animation right now. He practices every day. So what advice can you give to other, you know, young animators that are looking to break in?
Well, he will be rich. It's a huge time. It's a great time for animators right now. A great time because every movie is animated. Mm-hmm. So there's animators working on all the Marvel movies, all the Star Wars movies, all the DC movies. Every studio in town, Warner Brothers, Paramount, is making animated features. It's an international business. You can work in animation in Los Angeles or London or Vancouver or Tokyo or China. And there's a demand. There's a huge demand for visual effects artists and animators right now. As with any craft, as with playing the piano or hitting a baseball, learn your basics, you know, really study and learn the basics. And that is about acting and timing and the technique and technology of animation. Animation is nearly all digital now, so learn your software. And whether you go into storytelling in movies or gaming or whatever, those skills are really really valued right now. And there's plenty of schools that teach it, either online or you can migrate to one of the great schools out there, like Ringling in Florida or Chapman University in Los Angeles, USC. There's 200 schools out there that teach great animation courses.
Okay, and how about yourself? What are you working on next?
I don't know. I'm looking for a documentary idea. I have a couple of thoughts, and I have some meetings next week just on with Disney Plus to talk about those thoughts. And I'm working on a book for Disney about the origin story of Disneyland. And that's about the early 50s, about where that came from and the deal with ABC that Walt and Roy made to send programming to ABC and how that turned into Disneyland. And then the early sketches and pencil sketches for Disneyland and how that turned into the park. So I'm doing an origin story on that I've been working on for a while.
Oh, I look forward to that as well. Wow. And how can people follow you on social media?
Well, that's a good question. I'm on I'm on Facebook. I'm on Instagram at Don Hahn, I think. So I'm out there if you search me on Instagram or Facebook. I'm not on Twitter because I just don't understand Twitter. It seems like tedious and weird. Maybe Elon Musk will do something with it. So I'm out there and I try to respond to people, not in terms of stories and things, because I can't respond to people that send me stories or scripts, but sometimes people ask, as you did, like yes. advice for their son or daughter. And I'm really happy to help out with that, because that was me at one time. You know, I had to ask. And some of the guys at Disney really helped me when I was a youngin'. And it's a real pleasure to do the same.
Well, Don, we thank you so much for joining us today. It was such an absolute pleasure to get to talk to you. I've been looking forward to this, to getting to speak to you.
Oh, thanks. Well, same here. Thanks for reaching out. I appreciate your questions and what you guys do too. It's Disney's a hard thing to wrap your head around, and I think the more people that can talk about it and cover it and understand it, the better, because it's a really wonderful, special concept. You know, yes, yeah. There's Disney the corporation, yes, there's Disney the parks and everything else, but the philosophy of Disney I think is really interesting as well.
Well, we were just talking, you know, you have so many credits. So I'm sure in the comments, we're going to get about the things that we didn't cover. But in, when you decide to do the next venture, you're welcome back. We'd love to have you. If you want to talk about that as well, we'd love to have you on.
Thank you. That's really nice. Well, I really appreciate it. Love talking to you guys.
Well, again, this has been Pop Culture Retro. I'm Jonathan Rosen with Ike Eisenman. And again, a very special thanks to Don Hahn. And please subscribe.
Thank you for listening to Pop Culture Retro, where no one was hurt during the making of this podcast.